We'll call the meeting to order. Representative Mahoney, why don't you just get up there and start on 1208, and we'll wait until we got a quorum, and then we'll act accordingly. And do you have a delete all amendment?
It's not a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair. It is one that I'm going to have to walk the committee through.
Okay.
I tried to get a delete all, and the reviser.
That's okay.
It looks like I used to get to my parents long ago.
Representative Mahoney, why don't you just start on the bill, and as soon as there's a quorum, you can offer the amendment, and we can move the bill and then offer the amendment. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, House File 1208 is a second engrossment. It is a bill that deals with the Department of Labor. Many of the things in here are language and clarification and some instructions. The meat of the bill kind of gets, the first article is just reviser's instructions. The Article 2 is fire code, and this particular version, but the amendment will change this, switches that over to labor and industry, and it has some definitions and transfers of power. I'm just going to go through the bill summary. It is the Section 4 deals with the Construction Code Fund. Section 5 is bonding authority, saying that the bonds are not part of the state, are not state bonds or contracts for purpose of sections 805. The commissioner in Section 6 is the commissioner is not subject to subpoena enforcement, which is Article 3. And I could go through that whole article, but suffice to say that is pretty much all the language that was over at the Department of Health concerning the plumbing board, the plumbers over at the Department of Health, as it was explained to me by the department. They took the best language of all the department code departments and superimposed it on all the others. And maybe I should back up. This bill puts into law, what is it, the reorganization executive order 193, which brought all the codes from all its, you know, the Department of Administration, the Department of Health, Public Safety and everything, and put it in over in the Department of Labor and Industry. So anyhow, that Article 3 deals with the penalties and the enforcement and penalties, and again, that was primarily the language that was dealt with from the Department of Health. Article 4 is the building code, and that really, they did such a good bill summary on, like I say, I'm just going to follow that. There's a lot of technical changes and language updates in this building code language in here. If you go through it, it changes things from, like, up to date to the word into, changes the definition of person with physically disabled, the person with a disability, general powers of the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, the administration talked about surcharges. Much of it is, again, language updates and technical changes in Article 4. Article 4.
We have a quorum now, so Representative Mahoney moves House File 1208. He recommends that and be re-referred to Representative Murphy's committee?
I believe so, sir.
Okay, that's the motion. And then Representative Mahoney moves House File, the 0592 amendment. Do you want to explain that?
Yes, and I will walk through that.
Were you done with the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I can go on for an hour or two on this bill.
You don't have to.
This amendment, again, I was trying to take out some of the redundant language and a few other things, take away some of the boards. There's a mechanical board, systems board in here, a fire protection board in here. That was removed. The Board of Electricity that is created in this bill was way more complicated than it needed to be. And I had the language drafted to match up to the high pressure board and the plumbing board. I deleted the first construction code board because it is repeated later on in the bill. I changed corrected a couple of typos. There was one place in here. Let me find it on page 66 where I had in one version of the bill it came in as $100 and it really should have been $15. There is on page, I think it's, let me check on here so that I don't do it wrong, because this was asked but in a couple of other committees. Many of you may remember a few years back on page 62, a few years back we had quite the controversy about low voltage wiring, and there was some concern about that. One of the amendments in here inserts on page 62, line 20 and 22, after the word work, it inserts required to be performed by a licensed individual. That is, that assures that low voltage wiring can be done.
Can I stop you right there?
Pardon?
Can I ask you a question specifically to that? Because I had the local guy that's third generation TV store, and they do wiring for cable, and they thought that your bill initially would, they'd require an electrician to hook up the cable for your TV set, but so would that correct?
That is correct.
That does.
They didn't. They never had to, and they don't now.
Okay.
On page 108, line 15, the building, there's 16 hours of continuing education, and that is changed from this amendment to 7 at the request of the Builders Association. I'm under the impression that that was at some level negotiated earlier this year. I have a verbal amendment when I'm done with this. On page 179, line 24 on the...
Well, why don't we vote on the, unless you want
to... I'm almost done, Mr. Chair, and then we can vote on the amendment. Line 179.24 through 26, I'm deleting the chairperson of the Board of Construction Codes will be the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, because the line right below it says the board shall select one of its members to be the chair, and that's the way it's been written in the other boards. On 180, we delete the mechanical board and the fire protection board. In Article 16, on page 181, is the fire protection council or board, and that's deleted. On 187, Article 19, is the mechanical systems board. There seems to be some disagreement, and that needs to have a little work done on it yet.
So are you deleting that in your amendment?
I'm deleting that in this amendment. And then on the in the amendment, on starting on page 6, line 11, it's a budget balancing amendment, which I need to make a bit of a change, the verbal amendment. But what this budget balancing section of this amendment does is make this bill revenue neutral, and then we'll take it into conference and see how it's going to get paid for it. But I need to also change this strike on line 6, I'm sorry, page 6, line 13. The words estimated to be $3,663,000, comma. And then on line 6.17. The same language, only the number would be 3,572,000, comma. And that gets us neutral, Mr. Chair.
I think those incorporations, we can do, council can do that. What was the one on that you eliminated the chair, the Commissioner Dolly from being the chair? Did you get that?
Well, that's in the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, it is. Okay.
There's one other verbal amendment after we adopt this that I'll make that makes...
Well, why don't you...
No, I...
It's in the full bill?
It's in the part of the bill, and
okay.
We just made the agreement at about 5 o'clock this afternoon. So
why don't we do this first, then? So does everybody understand that the verbal amendments to this... or the oral amendments to this amendment. You're basically just striking on page 6 those words. Okay.
Yeah.
That's easily understandable to everyone. Any questions on that? Any questions on the amendment itself? All those in favor of the 0592 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, if I could go back to... there's been a lot of concern from the municipal building officials, actually the building officials and the building inspectors, and this is a very small verbal amendment on page 175.5 and 186. They were concerned that in the boards, those boards had control over the building officials and building inspectors. And they asked if I would remove "and inspection." And there is another that we will get in probably on the floor. It's a little bit longer, much too long to do on the fly. I'd like to get it written down, and I could not get the reviser to do it in time. But essentially what it does is the next amendment and the next committee will talk about taking any education over these inspectors and officials out of this bill.
Okay. Council, you, on 175, we're deleting "and inspection" on 175.5?
Correct.
And where was your other reference?
The other one was 186.11.
And the same thing there?
Same thing there.
Same language.
Same language.
186.11, "and inspection." Council, does that work in both places? The grammar doesn't seem that good, but we don't care about grammar here.
I figured on 175, cover that right. One.
Installation, alteration. It would probably use the there's a comma out, maybe installation, alteration of plumbing. Well, we'll fix the grammar. We're not that worried about it. It's just the concept, so. We'll correct your poor English.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Later on. Okay. You've heard those oral amendments on 175 and 186. Any questions on those? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. What does the department think of this bill now?
They think that about 80% of it is their language and 20% is my language, but the 20% was the important language.
Mr. Kowski?
I'm very happy with some of it, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to say anything? Are you happy? Are you happy as you can be at this point?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Are you as happy as you can be at this point?
I talked.
We could make you unhappier, more unhappy.
No, John, this lobbyist is a good guy. We don't want to make him any less happy than he is.
Mr. Kowski, opinions from the Department of Labor. And industry.
Mr. Chairman, would you be taking testimony on this? For a few
I'm
minutes?
Taking it right now.
All right.
That's why I called you up.
All right. I'll tell you about the 20% that Representative Mahoney referred to is where we still have some serious work to work on.
And your concerns are, if you can briefly touch on your concerns in the bill,
Mr. Chairman,
now as amended.
Generally, I'll keep it real short, but we need to work on the... authoritative versus advisory functions which are laid out on these building trade councils. That's our main concern with Hartburn.
Well,
the fiscal we just saw what to keep it fiscally neutral. What Representative Mahoney said, we'll be able to work that out. We've been working last week and today with the Senate on our fiscal issues, and I understand you are a fiscal and policy making committee. So we'll just continue to keep working with the representative on this, but we still have some serious concerns.
Okay, and I'm sure that Representative Mahoney is much more reasonable than I am when it comes to compromising. Is the other are both sides, Representative Mahoney, of the both the contractors and the building trades, are they completely happy or partially happy?
Mr. Chair, committee, building trades are happy. The contractors have not voiced any concerns that have not been addressed. The inspectors are comfortable with the language. Once that language was removed and the promise to remove the other language, whether it's on the floor or wherever, I'm sorry, add the language. And again, I'm trying not to make this too confusing. I couldn't get it to the revisers. So there's still work to do, and I agree with the department, and we're coming closer to our agreements, and John knows that Mr. Pelsky knows that my door is always open.
Representative Hartman.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. My mind was wandering for just a moment, and I missed the part that you're unhappy with. Can you just briefly again say what is it that you're unhappy with?
Me being the chair.
Being in the chair.
Representative Hartman and Mr. Chairman, our major concerns have to do with the construction of these authoritative boards. The Board of Electricity, not so much, but the Board of Plumbing and High Pressure Piping. We went into this reorganization, the governor, 2 years ago almost, where he put these five different disciplines under one roof. The folks who came over from plumbing and the folks who came over from building code from the Department of Administration, frankly, the advisory councils, they had grievances with how those advisory councils have worked. And I shouldn't be speaking for the other side, but I'm trying to give you both sides here. Their concern is that they will still there'll still be the potential for those grievances not being heard under this new reorganization that we have now through the construction code and licensing division at the department. They have been over at the Department of Labor and Industry for about a year and 5 months, and they don't know how this is going to play out, and this is their reaction to how they would like the world to be as far as having regulation over the building codes and licensing. So a lot of it has to do with timing of the reorganization order and the reorganization of the department, and then the legislature and the trade groups' reactions to this. That's why I said we continue to work on it.
The department, in a nutshell, they don't like us writing laws, even though that's what we do. Okay. Anyhow, Representative Norton.
Chair Rukavina, Representative Mahoney, I did receive a letter from a constituent who is indeed a building code inspector, though the issues that you talked about I don't think address his concerns, so let me just share those. His question kind of was in the same line as I just heard about whether this is an advisory board or a rulemaking board, and he was also concerned about the individual groups working separately, and his rationale was that the federal government is trying to work so that codes and code law become more uniform, and he was afraid that this method would further divide that and not have the uniformity that he thought they were working for. And just, he also said he pointed out he's been a union member for 30 years, and he just questions whether he thinks tradespeople should have input, but he worries about them making sole decisions. So I just thought I would point those out, that I don't think what you shared will address the concerns that he raised, and perhaps as you work further with the department, maybe you can address some of his concerns.
Representative Mahoney, do you want to comment?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, there's two or three things here, and I'll start that for 25 or 35 years, there were these type boards in different departments, And though they did not have rulemaking authority, they were the ones that put these codes together. And they were made up of licensed tradespeople and contractors and state inspectors, some department people. And then all of a sudden, about 4 or 5 years ago, that was totally wrong, and we shouldn't do that, and that was all thrown out the window, and we got some other system. Your other question was, the other part of the question was the...
Chair Covina, Representative Mahoney. Well, it sounds like he was concerned about there not being uniform codes
in the end. Model code. And we went about 4 or 5 years ago. There was a push across the nation to go to model codes. In the bill, it's obvious that your building inspector was one of those that got a blast email from an organization that doesn't like this until we had a long conversation. In this bill, in numerous places, the word model code, the phrase conform to model codes, towards codes that are in use across the nation, across the United States. So that's a battle that was fought and decided 4 or 5 years ago. I tried to keep enough language in here that keeps that from ever coming back. So.
Go ahead.
Chair Covina, add one more thing, and I appreciate you addressing that. The other question that I had all by myself, without help from an email from constituents, was on your amendment, and I'm sure it's throughout on all the boards, is the Commissioner of Labor and Industry shall provide office space, administrative support, and staff assistance as requested by the board. And if that's true of all five or six of those groups, I wondered, you mentioned it being cost neutral. Does that account for what could be fairly significant demands from five or six different boards?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, there are these advisory councils in place at the current time and have been. I don't foresee a whole lot of difference in what they have been spending versus what they will spend. Certainly, as you set something up and as you put rulemaking in, yes, there will be some extra and added costs. We're going to work on that. And members, I want you to know, and I have the building inspectors here, I have the trades here, I have some contractors here, but in the sense of time, unless there's a question or doubting my word about the deal, and that's more from finance today.
I'm doubting you.
Like I say, if there's anyone that would care to hear from any of these other groups, they're here to testify if you'd like.
I was going to ask if there was any. But Representative Norton. Were you done, Representative Norton?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. I like to get down to really the simple questions and the simple answers. And I guess my question would deal with your bill, which is quite lengthy. In the bottom or at the end of this this legislation, does it have any effect on the cost of housing in or building in the state of Minnesota? Are there negatives or is it neutral? I guess I'm concerned about housing right now and being careful we don't do something to slow it down more.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nordis. I don't think it should. I don't know why it would. This is these boards are really going to, in the end, adopt model codes that are pretty much across the nation. They'll have amendments in them. Such as in Florida, they build to 120 wind speeds or 100 miles an hour winds, versus in Minnesota, we build to 50 or 60. In Florida or Texas, they bury their pipes 2 feet. We bury them often below frost line.
20 feet up north.
So that's to the granite, sir.
And we do build to 120 mile an hour winds within about 10 mile radius of the Capitol, right?
Yeah. I thought it was just your house, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But I don't envision them changing any way, shape, or form the cost, although there's been some fear voiced in emails that I've seen about these trade groups imposing one thing after another, and you've got contractors that want to build homes or businesses and buildings, and they're not trying to raise the cost because the cost is already high enough. So I don't envision it.
Is there anybody from labor or the trades or the chamber or the contractors that want to comment on this? Okay, Matt. Any questions? I just asked them. Did I say inspectors? Do they want to speak on it? Doesn't look like anybody really wants to. So there must be some sort of peace in the valley.
Well, there's a truce.
Yes, okay. You're more than welcome to come up here. Okay. That's not the case. Well, we have... is there somebody coming up? Oh, okay, here we go. We got a testifier. Welcome to the committee, sir. Andrews and Nina.
Well, good evening. My name is Brian Hoffman, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Hoffman.
I represent the Association of Minnesota Building Officials here today, and just wanted to distributing our public service vision here that we really believe in, and we want to appreciate Representative Mahoney's amendments today to remove what we saw as being a conflict, basically, with the boards and the inspectors. So with that, those amendments we offer today, we are no longer objecting to the bill, and we actually look forward to working with Representative Mahoney as well as the department to make sure that these proposed boards can, in the end, work out really well for everybody's best interest. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman, do I recognize you from moldy buildings from over the last few years, or no, is that a different issue?
No, I haven't been involved with those.
Oh,
so.
Okay. I was wondering if it corrects those.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, I want to publicly state here that there's another amendment to this bill, but I could not get it done, that will address the concerns of the building officials and building inspectors dealing with education issues and further continuing education and the boards and the inspectors, which will take the inspectors out of any need to deal with the boards on that one.
Okay. Questions for the bill from the members? Any other comments? Representative Mahoney removes his motion that House Bill 1208 be, as amended, be recommended to pass, as amended several times, be recommended to pass to the higher the education and whatever, Mary Murphy's committee.
Staff will take care of
it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative, was Representative Babney in the room? Okay, Representative Moe. Representative Moe moves that House Bill 790 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Education, Finance, and Economic Competitiveness Committee. You want this to travel on its own, right, Representative Moe?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be brief, and then I'll turn it over to Terry Coleman, who can answer all of your questions.
Representative Mo, do you want to move your amendment?
Yeah, but first I'd like to move the amendment, the
0395
amendment.
Representative Mo, move the 0395 amendment. Do you want to briefly explain it to the committee?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Coleman will do that.
Mr. Coleman, welcome.
Go ahead, you can start.
Yes,
I won't.
Yes, okay, they're passing it all right now.
Mr. Chair, I'll address the amendment. And this just makes the bill conform with the Senate version. As much as we tried when we put this together early on to try to codify 446A, there were still a lot of little things that were missing or errors, and the Senate Council caught quite a few of them. I didn't realize the word such was banned from the Senate's vocabulary. So
such?
Yeah, so that was taken out, things like that. So they're real minor grammatical errors. To get in, but that's kind of the amendment, just real small technical stuff. The
Did they still ban common sense from their dictionary over there?
We try. But very briefly, Chapter 446A is the Public Facilities Authority Act. The PFA, or the Public Facilities Authority, really consists of six state agency commissioners and a relatively small staff, where we deal with municipal finance issues related to drinking water, wastewater, some transportation, credit count, or county credit enhancement, which we work criminal justice, juvenile justice, or social service type buildings, and meth lab cleanup. So there are quite a variety of issues we get involved in. And the board is a multiple agency. Everything the authority does literally has another agency involved with it, in setting priorities, certifying projects for funding, setting priorities, things like that. So with that, the chapter itself has been amended every year since it originally passed in 1988, 1987. So it's been 20 years this year, and a lot of inconsistencies in language, duplication of language, are scattered throughout the chapter. So we're just trying to clean it up so when we're done, the chapter would be readable. And we are making a few program changes that I would get into in a bit as well.
Mr. Coleman, do you want to, did you hit on the amendment? Is that?
Yes, the amendment is just all real minor technical grammatical things that the Senate wanted.
So there's
substantive whatsoever.
Nothing in here at all that.
No.
And just maybe a brief for our freshmen, I mean, this is basically a bonding authority, more like, isn't it?
Yes, the Public Facilities Authority is a bond issuer. We are AAA rated by all three rating agencies. We had a AAA before the state had theirs. So we're well known in the marketplace, and we have $1.5 billion for the revenue bonding authority. There's no state backing other than the funds we get to match federal dollars and program funds we get. So it's not a liability of the state. It gets paid back with revenues from interest earnings and loan repayments.
Representative Moore, is there anything in the bill that would cause any concern with?
No, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Coleman could answer in-depth questions if anybody had them. But if going through the bill, just as the previous bill we heard going through in detail would take some time. I would just remind the committee that all of the clean water legacy work that we do, safe, clean drinking water work, kind of the grants, local units of government, all those things are administered by the Public Facilities Authority. So it's an important function of government for everything else that we do. I guess I would just then, unless you had anything you definitely want to point out, I would say that we should just stand for questions.
Are there any specific questions on the bill?
There have been no controversies in any previous committees.
Is there anyone against this bill?
No.
Is there anyone in the audience against this bill? Is there anybody in the audience for this bill?
Mr. Chair, actually it does do a few good things. I did read the bill last night.
Well, the two people I saw being for it, now I've got some questions on the bill, so. No, okay. Members, I think this is pretty much a housekeeping bill, but Representative Moe then has offered the 0395 amendment. If there are no questions to that, let's vote on that. All of us in favor? Representative Norton, do you have a question on that? No. Excuse me, Norton? Representative Norris, do you have a question on the amendment? Okay, all those in favor then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have House File 790 as amended that it be recommended to pass and referred to Representative Murphy's committee as the motion was. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Dabney is not here. Representative Dabney, well, he's not here. Would someone from the Department of Employment and Economic Development come down? Mr. Nelson, are you going to handle this one? I don't believe now that there is any problem. I think this has been worked out, too, but maybe I'm making assumptions I shouldn't. As we're finding Representative Dabney,
The gist of this bill is that certain people, if they get laid off, that were on Social Security, couldn't get any unemployment insurance. There was a compromise, I believe, reached between the department and Representative Dabney. So, Mr. Nelson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is a delete-all amendment. I don't know if you have that before you.
Do we have a delete-all amendment?
Nope.
Who's got it?
It was given to the one of the pages, I believe, that would be photocopied.
Maybe Anders? Where's Anders? Is that him right there?
Found it.
Okay, we have the delete all amendments. We'll be passing that around. Okay, the 0571, while we're waiting for Representative, I will move the 0571 amendment. Why don't you explain it, Mr. Nelson, and then we'll vote on the amendment. I guess I didn't move the bill either, did I? Okay. I'll move that House File 2310 be recommended to pass. And Representative Dabney, this is a pretty straightforward bill with, now I understand, not that much controversy or none. So you want it to move on its own?
Representative Rukvina, of course, defer to your preference, but I do think it's able to move on its own.
Okay. I'll move that 2310 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Mary Murphy's committee. That's easier. Okay. Now I will move the 0571 amendment for you, Representative Dami. You and Mr. Nelson want to explain the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina, members. Mr. Nelson is going to put it in far more technical terms, but the current situation is, if you're a worker who's collecting Social Security and are laid off from your job, the state offsets your unemployment compensation $1 for every $2 you receive in Social Security. Under the amendment, in plain English, Mr. Nelson will provide the technical interpretation later, if you are collecting Social Security and are laid off from your job, you will experience no offset. If you are laid off from a job and then apply for Social Security, the offset will continue. I will now allow Mr. Nelson to interpret that into more technical language.
Give us the Greek version.
There we go.
Mr. Chairman, I would concur with that general explanation. I don't know if you want something more complex, and that's a little bit more complex, but that is generally what it is. What you do, there's no offset. If you have demonstrated that you are an individual who, while collecting Social Security, is intent on working, and you have shown that by, in fact, working and collecting Social Security, as opposed to an individual who's laid off and then decides to file for both. If you would file, be laid off and then file for both, there would continue a 50% offset, as we call it. 50% of your Social Security would be offset against your unemployment benefits. And I might point out that 50% offset has existed in one form or another in the law since 1937. So it's not a new deduction. This is a significant modification to the law that's existed since 1937. But it is a law which is in somewhat the same form now in 41, I believe it is 41 other states, and I believe it's 41 states. So Minnesota would simply be getting on the bandwagon. Most of the states are going.
And the department is fine with the new language?
The department is neutral on this particular language.
Okay. And I think I see that this bill came right to me, so I can send it right to the floor.
Mr. Chair, a fun reflection. It seems to make a more coherent package if you would be willing to lay it over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill. What is the Chair's preference?
I could do both.
You know, Mr. Chair, the best of all possible worlds.
We can send it to the floor and we can put it in the bill.
Can we send it to the Senate as well?
We'll send it right to Governor Flynn.
Deal.
Representative Steverson, hold on a second. Members, does anybody on either side of the aisle have a problem with just putting in the omnibus bill then? Okay, but we'll still make the motion to send it out to the floor in case something happens to our omnibus bill. Okay. Representative Nornan. Yes,
Mr. Chair, just kind of curious, are we talking, trying to figure out who would be perhaps taking advantage of this? Would this be somebody then 62 and over, or who possibly would be experiencing the situation we're dealing with?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norris, anyone who's collecting Social Security. You could be 62, you could be any age.
Representative Dabney, do you have a particular reason? Did you have a constituent request this for a specific reason?
Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by AARP. They have been concerned about this across the country. Minnesota is now one of, I think, as Mr. Nelson indicated, nine states. Eight, I'm corrected.
Yes,
that still has this offset provision. For me, the fundamental point here, members, is that retirement ain't what it used to be.
Right. And Representative Nornes, I would assume that anybody that's collecting Social Security disability, too, would probably... Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Nelson, but I was...
Mr. Chairman, they would also benefit under the same provision. If they, in fact, working while collecting Social Security disability, which is a possibility under the various definitions, if they do that, if they demonstrate they can, in fact, do that, then there would be no offset. If they, in fact, are collecting Social Security disability but haven't actually worked while doing that, but can show they are able to work under the statutory definition, then there would be a 50% offset, the same as for the old age provision.
Representative
Steverson. Mr. Chair.
One quick question.
Has nothing to do with the bill. I just wondered if Mr. Nelson has ever been mistaken for Johnny Carson.
Oh.
I know he's dead, but...
It is not.
Impersonators these days have a pretty good thing going. So,
Mr. Chairman, only when dealing with Representative Rukavina have I gotten this gray hair. So, before that, I was had a big bushy hair, black hair, like
short, big mouth. Okay. Anyhow, Representative Steverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to the bill, I got a couple questions here. It says any applicant age 62 or over. So would that preclude any people younger than 62 from receiving benefits, dual benefits under the Social Security Act?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stevenson, if you read on, any individual who's 62 or over has to inform the department when applying for benefits if they, in fact, have applied for Social Security old age benefits, which is the retirement portion, not the disability portion. That, in fact, isn't required by federal law to be asked for. It gets fairly complex on that area, but that simply tells us that they're applying for it. And then when that box is checked on the form, if you will, then we automatically will cross-check with the Social Security Administration. But if somebody's not applying, we don't even necessarily look at that. But if they are, in fact, applying, then we would see whether these other provisions apply.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson. I guess the question I had when I originally saw this was then there is no federal requirement that says that you have to notify the Social Security office that you are indeed working and making a certain amount. There's none of that provision that we would be violating.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, no, we wouldn't be violating. As indicated, there are, 43 states, 42 states, which don't have an offset. What federal law requires is that the state actually deal with the Social Security deduction. You can't say nothing. That's why it has to go on and say that there is no deduction if they meet these requirements. Federal law says states must consider Social Security when paying. They don't indicate how you have to consider it. So the law says you have to literally say there is no deduction. That's why it's put in here this way. That's all federal law currently requires, that the state deal with it one way or another, and this says there's no offset.
Okay, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is how many people are experiencing the offset now that would be affected by this bill? What kind of numbers are we talking about are having this offset taken out of their unemployment benefits, and how many dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, according to Mr. Nelson, the conversations we've had, it's about 4,000 people. I believe, I won't quote Mr. Nelson on this, my understanding from the conversations I've had, it's primarily 4,000 lower wage workers.
And Mr. Nelson, the hit to the fund is insignificant?
Chairman,
or is there even a hit to the fund? I suppose there is. Wasn't there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lugavine, if there were no deduction at all, we don't know, we don't know how much this exactly would cost the fund. If there were none at all, and this still provides for a 50% offset for some people, it would cost about $8 million a year. So we're wiped out totally for those 4,000. But now this says there's no deduction only if you have in fact worked, demonstrated that, and then file for Social Security while collecting. Excuse me, if you work and are collecting Social Security and then are laid off, there would be no offset. I can't give you an exact number on that. But we know it will impact positively about 4,000 Minnesotans who are lower wage workers. We know that.
And I would. So many of those are probably stay-at-home housewives, because I see a lot of them working in the elderly. That's okay. No other questions on the bill? Then I'm going to renew my motion. Well, actually, I'm going to make a new motion that House Bill 2310, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson, is he around? Representative Nelson is here. Representative Nelson moves. Listen, members, we got a little mix-up on this bill. And Representative Nelson's bill, we were told Friday, came to our committee, but then I was told about 2 hours ago that it's not officially in my hands. So we're going to just have an informational hearing on this bill when we show the bill tomorrow, if you like it, because I don't think this is that controversial, but maybe it is. I don't think so. I think you heard. Well, we'll listen to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then we'll decide what we're going to do with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I don't understand why there was nothing going on Friday, so I don't know why they couldn't get it out and everything here. I mean, it's like the revisers aren't doing anything up there, are they?
Before
being sarcastic.
Mr. Chair, can I tell the revisers he just said that?
I'm being sarcastic.
Before we do that, though, Representative Slocum, would you care to move the minutes for me, please?
So moved.
Representative Slocum.
Yes.
So moved. The Thursday, March 22nd minutes, are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. Okay, Representative Nelson, we can get you in and out of here and we can all go and eat.
We can all go eat, yes. Anyway, the workers' misclassification bill is what this is about. I've been working with the department and working with contractors and working with the unions to go after this problem of misclassified workers. And these people are workers that should be employees, should have withholding paid on them, should be having workers' comp paid on them, unemployment, the whole nine yards. And what's happening is they're being told that they're independent contractors, or they're setting up shams where they're independent contractors, so they're not paying into workers' comp, they're not paying unemployment, and they're not having taxes withheld. And it's becoming a rampant in the construction industry, and it's cheating our taxes, our state funds, or our state general fund out of taxes that should have been collected on these people. The piece of the bill that why it got brought to this committee here is there's the department setting up a system where they're going to register the people that want to be legitimate independent contractors. They come in, they prove, they sign an affidavit, they fill out the form saying, yes, I'm going to meet the 9 points that we have currently in the law, and I am going to be an independent contractor, and they get an exemption certificate. And there's a $150 fee that's being set up for this certificate to fund the department being able to audit these people, the department being able to
to process and do the work that they have to do to make sure that the people are legitimate independent contractors. And that's what we're here to talk about, and that's the part of the bill that's a, that this committee has purview over.
Questions? Is there anybody here from the Department of Labor and Industry that stayed? They knew this bill was on the agenda.
Nancy Lepic, who's...
Why don't you come up for just a second and... are you... Welcome to the committee.
My name is Nancy Lepping. I'm the general counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. And I've worked with Mr. Nelson on this bill.
So
Representative Nelson.
Where is the department standing on this?
Department's in support of this bill.
Okay. Any questions? Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative Nelson, is this an annual fee or a one-time fee?
It'd be every 2 years. It'd be $75 a year and $150 every 2 years. The certificate would be good for 2 years, and then they'd have to come back and renew it. And again, sign the affidavit that they are truly improved the 9 points that are in law and they're in the bill.
Representative McFarland?
Chair, should that be part of the wording here, or is that just a policy?
Actually, it's in the bill.
It is.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the committee's sake, this has been a concern of Representative Nelson and myself for a number of years now. And I have to say I'm thrilled that he's finally found a resolution to this one. My question is... is there other states that do this, and what's been their experience? Have they seen injuries lowered, or taxes go up or go down? Or
well, this is Representative Mahoney and the chair. This bill is modeled after what was done in Montana. In Montana, where they claimed to have the highest number of independent contractors before they put this into effect. And they came out of a Supreme Court ruling in their state having to do with the way it was they were handling it before. And this was, again, labor and industry worked together to come up with this system. But they went from having 34,000 independent contractors to cut that in half to 17,000 legitimate independent contractors. The rest of those people became employees of other contractors, and the tax revenue came up to state. People were then covered under workers' compensation. So this is what we're trying to get at, is making sure that people, when they get injured, they're covered by that. When they get let go of work, that they collect their unemployment, and that when they're working, that they're paying their fair share taxes in, so everybody pays less when everyone pays their fair share.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Go ahead.
Was there any evidence that their uncompensated care in their hospitals in and around Missoula and Helena and Bozeman went down? I'm certainly hoping for some of that.
That was one of the ways that, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that was one of the ways that they did, that they used to sell it, and actually I haven't seen the evidence, but they're saying that has gone down. They're saying that the cost of uncompensated care for people that are working without workers' compensation, when they get injured, they're going to the hospital either as uncompensated care, or they're going on their wife's or their spouse's health insurance and raising the cost of health care. And this is they look at this as a way of keeping health care costs down, because uncompensated care will be covered.
Ms. Lepping, don't some of these people that are masquerading, and I don't think it's their fault, I think it's direction of the person that's employing them, as independent contractors, when they get hurt, then they end up in our special comp funds, or they try to fight to get into them, or and it costs. Go ahead,
Chairman Rapadina. How it would work is that if they are in fact employees, then the person who was found to be their employer would be considered to be uninsured, consequently, and therefore that would be an uninsured claim, and that claim then would go to the special compensation fund.
So they're costing us a lot of times in a lot of different places.
Yes.
In state.
Often.
Okay, Eastland first, I think, and then back to Detmer and then McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I think this is a good bill. I guess the question I have here is on line 213, 5A, it says that you're only an independent contractor if the individual holds a current independent contractor exemption certificate issued by the commissioner and the individual is performing service for the person under the independent contractor exemption certificate. What about a licensed contractor? I mean, who is out doing business as a licensed contractor? They have a business, and somebody asks you to bid to do the cement job here. I mean, do you have to now go one step farther and buy one of these things too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I believe no, they would not have to, because currently they are their contractors. They're hiring employees. They're legitimate contractors. They wouldn't have to go. We're talking about the individual. If you wanted to go out and start your company up and work for yourself and bid out on that work, you'd have to go and meet the 9 points that are in the current law, and they're stated in the bill here, and apply for this certificate so that then the commissioner would know that you are truly an independent contractor and that you're not trying to get around the system by claiming to be an independent contractor to get out of paying workers' compensation on yourself or your employees, unemployment, and the other things. And go ahead, that's what this is trying to go after, is the ones every now they're trying to cheat the system and get out of paying their fair share of their costs.
Ms. Leffing, you heard Representative Easton's question. I mean, they're not going to, a legitimate independent contractor, for lack of a better word, is not going to have to pay twice if he's already, right?
First of all, Chairman Rakovina, Representative
Eastland,
sorry. This bill only applies to individuals. So it's distinct from persons who are basically primarily business entities. So, but if you're an individual and you want to be in the business and working for someone, for a company or a person's in the business, then you would, in order to be an independent contractor, you would need to apply for a certificate, obtain an exemption certificate from the department.
Representative Eastman.
Okay, so that if I'm an individual and I want to create a sole proprietorship and I'm going to do some remodeling work and I go get my remodeler's license and I set up my business and I buy my insurance and all the things that are required through the department to get your license, now, because I'm an individual, I can't bid on doing the trim work in this house without having one of these certificates?
Ms. Leppard?
To be an independent Chairman Rakovina, Representative Eastland, to be considered to be an independent contractor. Now, first of all, if you're bidding with the homeowner, then this doesn't apply. Okay, so if you're bidding on a, if somebody wants, I want my house remodeled, and I get a bid from you, and I hire you as my contractor. This does not apply. This law does not apply because this law only applies to individual persons who are in the business of the construction business, hiring individuals to perform work for them.
Basically, I think, Representative Eastland, it's the subcontracting issue that
right.
They're trying to get at here. Then, you know, that guy that you talked about that is legitimate, the guy that he might be hiring,
he's gonna
to subcontract for him to go to that house, and he tells him when to show up to work. He tells him what to do to when he goes to work, where to buy this, what to do that. He's really not an independent contractor. That's the person they're trying to get at. Go ahead.
Well, I had
a mental block there.
That wasn't the question that I asked. Though I asked if there's a contractor who builds houses. And I'm a finish carpenter, and I am an individual. I work by myself. I go in and do the finish work in the house. I don't have any employees. But I go to the Department of Commerce. I have my license. I set up my business. I'm an official. I am XYB Construction. Here's my specialty. I have my license. And now, according to this, the way I read it, that guy would then have to have this permit as well before he could go out as a subcontractor. And do the thing that he's been doing all along. I mean, that's the one I'm kind of looking at.
In that specific instance, yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Eastland, yeah. In that specific instance, yes, you're right. He'd have to apply for that certificate to continue doing what he's doing. If he was only doing trim work, he would not have to have the residential license because he's only doing one specific part of the trade of the work. If he was doing multiple things in there, then you have to have the residential license. But if you're only doing one piece of it, the trim work or the siding or the roofing, and under the residential rules, you don't have to have a license to do that. You're just doing one piece of it.
Representative Eason.
I mean, I understand that, but if he is a licensed person, and there are a lot of guys who go out and get their license, and then they have a specialty that they do,
mm-hmm.
and that's their bread and butter, and they maybe do some other things once in a while, they contract some other stuff, but I'm just saying it seems like we're taking people that have already gone through a lot of hoops to get a license, you know, and to set up their own business, and now we're saying, no, you can't operate until you pay this fee, and I guess... That's where I understand the guys you're trying to get. It's the guys that go in and try to have all these people working and call them subcontractors, and they're just really employees. But there's a lot of people that operate like I just described, sole proprietors, individuals who are licensed and who have gone through the work to set up their business legitimately, gone and gotten their schooling and gotten their contractor's license, and they're doing their 7 credits a year and all that kind of stuff, paying their, you know, already there, the department already knows about it. And it seems a little bit redundant here that we're going to require those guys to go back and pay again to go and then use what they just spent a lot of money to get.
Representative Eastman?
Yep.
You know, I think maybe there's a way that we could solve this. We're just hearing the bill tonight. Of course, we can't amend it, but you're right. I know several of those small independent carpenters who asked, actually, several years ago for us to pass laws to protect them against the fly-by-nights, too. And they register at the Department of Labor and Industry, and they get their little certificate, and they take their schooling, required schooling, and I think they're required to be bonded, if I remember that legislation, as Archer passed it years ago. And so they're probably on record. So if there's a way we could make sure that if they're on record at the Department of Labor and Industry, you know, and there must be the same type of requirements for independent cement finishers or whatever, you're right, they shouldn't, because they're already meeting requirements, and they've already proved to the Department of Labor and Industry that they're, you know, they've got the insurances and workers, well, if they're by themselves, I suppose that's immaterial. But if you can figure out a way, Council, to address that, maybe you can work with Mr. Nelson on that. Do you have any suggestions, perhaps?
Chairman Rapavina, are you referring to the cost? Is that your primary concern? Is
he doesn't want to nick them twice.
I just think, you know, we're just throwing another kind of mandate out in front of them, saying you got to go through this hurdle and you got to pay this fee and you got to do one more time. And it just seems like they're the ones that are doing it right now.
Right.
They're not the ones that we're trying to hit with this thing. So if there's a way to be able to slice them out of the pie, it would be really beneficial.
Like if you're a sole proprietorship or you've got that small carpentry license and you're already registered there, they shouldn't have to do it again. Representative Mahoney?
To this point, I mean, the people that you're talking about, whether they're a finished carpenter or a independent plumber working out of his garage or her garage, they've got a license. They don't need a second license. They wouldn't need an independent contractor's license. More often,
we're not sure about that, and I see where I don't think the attorney from the department told us that either.
Talk to the department then.
That's what we're trying to get to the bottom of.
I think it's very simple. If you have a previous license or a general contractor's license, which most of these people do have, they would be exempt from this, so long as they're filing the 1099 forms.
Council, do you know what we're trying to get at here, and I thought I'd go ahead.
Chairman Rocavina, Representative Mahoney. The problem that this bill tries to solve is to as clearly as we can define who is an employee and who is an independent contractor. Often, whether you are licensed or not is a factor, but often it is not the determining factor of whether you are someone's employee or someone's independent contractor. So consequently, I would say that we might have licensed folks who clearly are people's employees, despite the fact that they have that license. We also have situations where people, if you meet the nine-factor test that's been established by law, you would be able to establish that you're an independent contractor. This bill does two things. One, if you don't have an exemption, you are an employee. So it will, in those instances, will no longer occur where only after you've fallen from the roof you discover you're an independent contractor of someone. If the moment you enter into the work relationship, if you don't have an exemption, you can have confidence that you are an employee. If you then proactively obtain the exemption, which means that I am taking myself out of the safety net that comes with employment, unemployment insurance, work comp, right to minimum wage and overtime, often health insurance, all sorts of things that we bring with employment in this state, you are proactively, affirmatively saying, I'm opting out. Then you are in a position to then negotiate and meet the nine-factor test, and you will then continue to be, then you can engage in a contract and be an independent contractor. But the work, you not only have to have the exemptions, but the work conditions have to continue to meet that of an independent contractor. I would maintain that even if you are licensed, there are circumstances where you would not meet the factors of being an independent contractor. So simply being licensed is not sufficient for purposes of making this call between whether you're an independent contractor or an employee. So consequently, what I had hoped, Representative Eastland, because you're right, a lot of the folks who are in the residential contracting have that licensure, would very likely be able to meet the independent contractor exemption requirements that are in this law. So consequently, I'd hoped that we would be able to provide for an application process so individuals could opt in to then, in addition, you know, a lot of the information would be the same to be a licensed residential contractor. If you want to add in the exemption, you could then, you know, whatever was not part of that licensing process but was required for the certificate, you would have the opportunity to do one application. All of your information would be reviewed once, and then you could walk out the door with both your license and your exemption certificate if you met the requirements. Now, certainly, I would think that, you know, there could be some fee adjustment if you're going to sort of bundle your application process such that you wouldn't have to have two distinct, basically providing much of the same information twice to the agency. So one of the values of having the residential contracting and having the licensure responsibility being with the department would be the opportunity for that. I'm not sure whether we will have that opportunity under the current bill that Representative Mahoney has brought forth, whether we will allow for that synergy, because those two processes may be in different agencies. So we would be doing the exemption and the residential contracting. Is there a board for residential contracting? No? I can't remember.
I think so.
Okay. Well, then we would be still in the same agency. But your plumbing licensure possibly would be in a different agency. Your other kinds of electrical, et cetera, conceivably would be in a different agency, and we would be foreclosed from having that opportunity to have those applications to a dual purpose.
One more. Representative. Go ahead, Representative.
It's a good argument to keep them all the same agency. But I think what you're saying makes sense. I mean, in my view, they should happen together. So when you get your license, whatever issue you have to deal with on this self-employment issue, that's all part of the same process. And it just seems to me that in just creating another hurdle and another $150 or whatever it is, I don't know. That just seems to be cumbersome, and it seems to be a bigger hit that we should be making to these guys. Because some of these guys, they don't make a lot of money. I mean, they're just a paycheck to paycheck kind of a, or I shouldn't say it that way, but I mean, job to job as they get paid. I mean, that's what they're doing. And most of them that I know, they're very legitimate. There's guys out there that clearly are not doing this, and I think we all know who they are. And we know how they operate. But there's a lot of very legitimate ones out there. And this is just putting another hit, another requirement on them. And I, Like, if we could do something to soften that, I think that would really make this a much better bill.
We're not doing anything on this bill tonight, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I've got two different contractor groups here, and they've been working with me on the bill. If you want, they could come and put their 2 cents in. They've been supporting this because what they're having happen is their members that are legitimate, the gentlemen, the people that you're talking about that are out there working, they're the ones that are getting hurt because they're being forced in a situation where they also have to cheat because they're bidding on work against these people who are truly employees but are working as independent contractors and cheating the system. They have to turn around and try and cheat the system also to maintain competitive.
Maybe by tomorrow or the next day, tomorrow we're going to just look at the bill and go through it, but maybe by the next day when we start hearing amendments, Representative Eastland, if this gets offered up, you can work with Representative Nelson, because I understand what your concern is, and I think we're smart enough to figure something out where we're not going to hurt that legitimate one. Representative Detman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and testifiers. You know, I support this bill. We know that a lot of times a bad apple ruins the whole basket. Do you have any idea how many bad apples we got out there and how widespread this problem is?
Maybe Department of Labor and Industry just can use, you probably have some figures, but a couple of examples about maybe the workers' comp applications or unemployment, whatever. Go ahead.
Representative, this issue has a multitude of facets, whether it's OSHA enforcement, where we don't have any authority if there's not an employer-employer relationship, to the work comp situation where you potentially have uninsured employers who then have, of course, uninsured employees. In that instance, the state, the special comp fund steps in, so you don't have the dire consequence for the individual and not for the worker in that instance. As for numbers, I don't have numbers. I have personal experience. I've represented the Department of Labor and Industry since 1988, both in the Attorney General's office and for the department. The issue of whether someone is an employee or independent contractor comes up weekly for purposes of work comp enforcement, OSHA enforcement, labor standards enforcement, and now I'm the final decision maker for the agency in the residential contracting. It's not as much of an issue there because most of the cases I see are with contracts between a residential contractor and a homeowner, which this law would then, that relationship it would not apply to. I don't really get that many cases in the residential contracting context where I deal with many of them. However, the confusion over whether someone's an independent contractor or not has been for years. I mean, several years ago, we amended the OSHA statute because there was a practice in some industries where one day you were an employee and the next day your employer walked around and had you sign a document that you all said you were independent contractors. Or it's in that sheaf of paper that you sign when you get hired that you also say that you're an independent contractor. It appears in all kinds of situations where there's, and then there can be the other side too, of course, where people want to hold themselves out as independent contractors and avoid child support and other kinds of things that of course is a price to all of us, because then you don't have any income, you don't pay child support. So there's this issue comes up in so many circumstances that I strongly believe that it's good public policy to try to the extent that you can draw clear lines and make it as simple as possible, so that whether you're the hiring entity or the laborer, you know what you are, you know what relationship you're in, and you can then act accordingly.
Representative Denman, there's a few in the bushel.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, did you have anything to add?
I just would tell people that many, many construction workers have multiple licenses, and I myself, I think, have 6 at the present time. But more importantly, so that everyone knows in this committee, I didn't move anything out of the Department of Labor and Industry. All the codes, all the licensing that was there is still there.
Okay.
Didn't do any of that.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a comment. When I'm looking at the fiscal note, in 2009, at $150, you'd have 12,500 people paying this fee. Does that seem reasonable? I mean, anecdotally, you were saying you get calls every week. Does this seem like a high number?
Ms. Leffing?
I'm sorry, 12,000 how often?
If you had to raise...
McFarland, where are you looking on the fiscal note?
I'm looking on the first page of the fiscal note, and it says for general fund revenue, it would be $1,875,000. If you were to divide that by the $150 fee, that's 12,500 people that would have filed for this certificate. Does that seem reasonable?
Ms. Leffing?
Chairman Rukavina, Representative, I would say that that would be a conservative estimate of the total number of individuals who would apply for this exemption. 12,000, yes.
Yeah. Okay. The back page of the fiscal note, page three of the fiscal note, it says 12,500 times 150 is 1,875.
Yeah. I'm observing that in fiscal year 2008, we're putting out $800,000. So over those 2 years, we'll put out $2 million to get back $1.875
million. We're front-ending this because of the way we have to do things around here for the general fund appropriation out of our budget for 1 year, and then the fees will cover it all after that. And they don't pay us back because it's just general fund money, and then it goes into the general fund. So. Members, no further questions then? No further comments?
Just one comment.
Representative Nelson?
Representative, Mr. Chair, to Representative Szymanski.
Szymanski, where is he?
Debra, I'm sorry. Pardon me.
All them Republicans look alike to me, too.
I didn't say that. You guys worked on part of the earlier committees. I handed out a report that was done by the state of Illinois or by the University of Kansas on the state of Illinois based on their stuff, on their workers' compensation and unemployment. And their auditing, they found out in this audit that they estimate 17.8% overall of the people are misclassified as independent contractors when they're truly employees. And I believe in the construction industry, which is just going to affect, it's up to 24% of the people that are classified as independent contractors truly are employees. So it is a large and growing number.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions, then. Thank you both. Members, tomorrow we're going to take up the bill. The bill is, here's the bill right now as we've drafted it. We have given the bill to Representative Nornes and Representative Gunther. For Republicans to see ahead of time, the bill just got done at 6 o'clock. Here is Representative Mahoney's bill. So our bill was this big tomorrow. If we do the Mahoney bill for the bill, it gets a little bigger.
I could vote no just for that
purpose.
Mr. Chairman,
but
I'm
this
just
is
trying
all
to
policy in
the timber industry in the state.
This is all policy. So members, tomorrow we're going to go through the bill, and then on Wednesday and Wednesday night, and if we have a little time tomorrow even, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot more questions than time to even start doing anything, but all day Wednesday, then Wednesday night we'll mark up the bill.
Okay? Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
And will there be an opportunity for amendments, and when would that be?
Wednesday and all, okay. Wednesday at 12:30, and when we, and Wednesday night at 6, we'll go until midnight, 1, 2, whatever.
6:30?
6:30 is fine with me. There's not anything controversial in this bill. And I know. Representative
Mr. Chairman.
Representative. Mr. Chairman. Representative Earhart, would you like to carry the meeting?
We're all good looking. But the rumors are that you've requested the state banned smoking bill to come to your committee.
That would not be in our bill at all. That is an independent bill traveling on its own. It is here. It is coming to this committee. It will be here. And we are going to look at the Representative Severson wanted to see it here, so we... And so
the question is, Mr. Chair, when's it going to be added here?
As soon as we can get a handle and wrap our arms around
not the waitresses. I can't see if that was Raffarin's the waitress problem. And what we're going to do with the workplace development funding. So then we'll it'll be out of here. I promised today in committee, and you heard what I promised. We'll get a handle on that. We'll make sure that if people lose their jobs, they're covered for retraining, and we will send it right back to where it came from. I have an idea where it should go, but I couldn't send it there without matches and a good burning barrel. Okay, members, with that, any questions about the bill tomorrow then? Okay. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.